I'm Dr. Don McDonald. Welcome to Breaking the Underdog Curse, the podcast. I believe one of the most valuable things you can give yourself as a chiropractor is taking time. Time to become more inspired, present, and focused. Weekly, I'll be bringing you stories of triumph, mindset shifts, and lessons from people who are breaking through their limitations. In order for chiropractic to thrive, we must have thriving chiropractors. Now, let's get started. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Breaking the Underdog Curse. I'm Dr. Don McDonald, your host, and today I get to go down to Austin, Texas. We're just on video chat, and I'm looking out at all the leaves while it's all freezing cold and snowy here in Edmonton, Alberta. But I'm super excited about this guest today. I got this book about a year ago, and I talk to it with all my practice members all the time because it has such amazing tools in it. My guest today is Jay Papasan. He's the co-author of The One Thing. He's a writer. He's in real estate. He's a husband, is a father. He's the man. And so I'm really excited to have you on the show. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Don. I'm excited to be here.
That's excellent. So as I talked to you on the pre-chat, we're talking to a lot of chiropractors from all over the world. And what we'd like to do usually to start off with is just get a little bit of history of kind of what was your path up to becoming co-author of The One Thing?
All right. Well, I've had quite a long career. I've been in publishing for about 20 years.
Yes.
So, and I've been in relationship with Gary now for 17. But nice. The book is now, it's been out there a little more than 4 years, and we spent almost 5 years working on it.
Wow.
So the true origin story for the book is I was working with Gary in our university. We have an in-house university, and I was directing the course development. And I was sharing a course with him, and he said, asked if he could take it home for the weekend to review. And he came back with a short essay called The Power of One. Mm. And it was all about how to be successful in his primary business, which is franchise real estate.
Yeah.
And it was all about, you know, you time block your number one priority and you make it a habit, basically, you know. And I just remember read that piece, and then I said, Gary, this is a book. And he goes, I thought the same thing. And that was the origin, right? It started with us looking at something else and applying a process and an approach that Gary's had in many areas of his life. He uses the same approach.
Yeah.
And it was the first time he had defined it so clearly, even though we've all been living some version of it. That's how you get to stay around the guy, right? Is that you buy into that system. And it gave us a chance to go out and really thoroughly research it and refine it.
Yeah, so, and just for where it started. Just for the listeners, can you maybe just explain a little bit who Gary is, just in how you got to meet each other?
If they're not familiar, Gary Keller, the co-author in the book, he's a guy in bigger letters than me, for sure. He started Keller Williams Realty, which today is the largest real estate franchise company in the world. When I joined the company in 2000, there were 6,700 agents, and today there's over 170,000.
Wow.
And it's not just a little bit, like he's built a machine, and I will call it that because it's systematic growth. And today, the gap between us and number two would be, I think, the fifth largest company in the world. Like it's not like a small gap, it's growing and growing. And I'm proud of that because it takes a lot to make that happen, but it's the same approach we talk about in the book. Yeah. We only track a handful of things, and we know it is number one at all times.
Well, and that's great because part of my book, The Underdog Curse, talks about sometimes people feel more comfortable being the underdog. And one of the most challenging thing is to be number one and stay number one. So I always talk about like Michael Jordan or LeBron James or somebody who's amazing, like the amount of pressure for them to come into the game knowing they're number one, they're expected to win and still perform. Like that's challenging. It's a lot easier to be an underdog and surprise everyone.
You read behind between the lines. If they don't have a reason to have a chip on their shoulder, they'll put one there though.
Yes.
And so they are competing with something greater than themselves at all times. So yep. If there's no one on the racetrack to race with them, they're racing with themselves in a very earnest and sincere way. That's been my experience interviewing top performers. Like, yeah, complacency at the top is a great recipe for being put out of business.
100%. And that's the
Gary's that's the not that way at all. He is always driven for the next thing. And he's finding a new place where we're not number one that we need to be.
Right.
And that's definitely, I don't know, that's a hallmark of some crazy, wonderful people that you get to spend time with.
Well, and I think there's always areas for improvement. So as long as you're staying aware and looking for those areas, I think that's the kind of the key to success. So let's talk about the overall underlying intent for the book of the one thing.
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of the success for the book, I think we did our job. We did the research. We tried to keep it simple. The subtitle to the book is The Surprisingly Simple Truth Behind Extraordinary Results. And there's two words I usually tell people that are really essential. We looked out and we tried to model extraordinary businesses and extraordinary people, not average.
Right.
I think there are a lot of ways to be average. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the definition, right? Is that almost anybody can approach that mark. But to be in the top 1% of any industry, our experience is that there are a lot fewer paths to that. So most people, I usually tell them, if you're arguing with this approach, which I feel like we did a good job of backing up, it's not the only way, but it's one of the few, you're probably arguing for average in your life in that area. And I got to tell you, I'm the king of average in a lot of things. I internalized, I mean, I wanted to be the Renaissance man. I'd clearly wanted the first half of my life was being trying to be that. And I failed. And what you learn is that you can be really extraordinary at just a handful of things, and you better pick them wisely. Right. And so we look at that. Extraordinary is an important word, and the other one is simple. And Gary is very clear. He's beat this into my head. People cannot live in complicated for very long.
Right.
We can try whatever that, you know, it's January when we're talking, right? So there's a whole world of people out there that are starting a new diet, a new fitness program that might end up in your offices, right? They are trying to be the new version of themselves.
Yeah.
And if they take on too much and it's too complicated, what we know, and this is why in my industry, the book industry, every January, go back through history, there's going to be a new batch of diet books and exercise books on the bestseller list for January.
Right.
And the whole industry knows that they can just repeat, repeat, and repeat every single year and get the same audience, because most people try things that are too much change too fast and they fail. So a lot of what we try to do is, how do we give people approach to first identify what's most important and then achieve that most important activity, not always the outcome, but we can do the activity that leads to it in a regular way. How do we communicate that in the simplest possible way? So the book is really about identifying what's my one thing, right? What's your one thing? Do we have a simple mechanism for that? And then how do we actually do that thing? The results that we'll get will be determined by our skill at doing it over time. But just the battle for most people is actually doing it.
Right. And even probably finding out what that is.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. I mean, we benefited in the book from timing. I think people right now, we talked about this before we started recording, there is a universal feeling of overwhelm.
Yeah.
It's not just because we have all these obligations. I really think it's also, to be positive, we have a lot of opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can stop at lunch to eat, you know, lunch. I either like to read a book, I catch up on email, or maybe I'll watch a video if I have a little bit of extra time. But I usually do it at working. It's a short 30-minute break. But if I need to check out, like maybe I'll look at a TED Talk. I mean, how many choices do I have to consume work mile information today that I didn't have 15 years ago, much less 30?
Yeah, it's so huge.
We have so many choices we can make. And I do think that people didn't have a good mechanism in general for making the best choices on how to invest their time. And in the grand picture, like Gary says, this book is about no regrets.
Right.
He wants to live a life of no regrets. And that's kind of like, let's avoid the negative side, right? But you avoid that by making great investments of your time. Are you appropriate in the moments that matter? When you're with your children, are you with them? When you're with your spouse, are you with them? And conversely, when you're at your job, are you actually there with it, faithfully giving it the attention it needs? That's not true for most people.
Right. Well, and I think that's the thing, is we talked to a lot of chiropractors, and I was talking to you that before the call, is that we have so many things on our plate. There's so many different things you can do. There's marketing, there's all these different things going on. And then sometimes us as chiropractors, we get overwhelmed as well. So I think what would be really cool, and I was seeing some of your videos before, is first of all, let's hammer multitasking. Because first we'll go, let's go on what we should not do first. And then we'll kind of dive into kind of like narrowing down on what things we should be doing. So tell us a little bit about the fallacy behind multitasking.
We did that in the opposite order in the book, but I like the idea is we write most of our books, Gary and I, and we start by what are the ideas we need to get out of people's head before we put the right one in.
Mm-hmm.
And multitasking was number two for us. Because when people are faced with a lot of things to do, one of their impulses is not to do the most important thing, but to do two things at once.
Right.
Right. And gosh, there's like seven different arguments for this. There was a guy named Clifford Nass. It was in 2009. And he looked up, saw all the claim around multitasking. Literally, I tracked this while we were writing the book. And it went from like the hundreds of thousands of web page to like over 3 million web pages on how to multitask. That was the phrase I kept entering over time. And every time I entered it, it was growing exponentially.
Oh, wow.
Right. And you could go to monster.com and you could right there on your application say, I'm a multitasker, as if that made you look more, right? It was a very attractive thing. So Clifford Nass is a Stanford scientist. He's not naturally someone who does two things at once. He's a focused individual. And he wants to ask the question, what are these people doing that makes them so powerful? So the important thing to understand is he went into the study with a bias that they had a special, unique power. And he got, you know, around 200, I forget the exact number, I think it was 208 graduate students. And half of them said, I'm an awesome multitasker. And half of them said, I stink at this.
Great.
He gave them a battery of tests, including multitasking. Mm-hmm. And when he wrote about it in the New York Times, this phrase that I remember is that multitaskers were suckers for irrelevancy. They were lousy at everything. So in every single test, including multitasking, the very thing they thought they were good at, the high multitaskers were outperformed by the low multitaskers.
Wow.
And so when we think we're multitasking, we think we're being more effective. We think we're being more efficient. And what we're really doing is wasting our time. We're getting worse results. And I can show you how it lowers your IQ to lower than someone who's high on weed, right?
Yep.
There are so many studies I can give you. It dumbs down your work. People who multitask chronically think it takes longer to do their work because for them it does.
Yeah.
Because being less efficient, and then they're being less effective, meaning they're a lot less likely to get the results they want than if they were doing monotasking, right? Focusing on one thing and doing things sequentially. I'm going to do my email and then I'm going to watch this, right? Instead of trying to do both at once.
Yeah.
And the real difference happens when people flip back and forth between their focus. They feel like they're doing it at the same time. But scientists actually call that switch tasking.
Right.
You're just switching back and forth below the conscious level. It's like walking and talking, right?
Yeah.
I can clearly do these two activities at once. But you can't do either of them as well, as easy as they are. If you were walking across a rope bridge across a chasm, I guarantee you, you would stop the conversation. You'd be like, Mom, I'm going to call you back.
Right?
And conversely, if you were negotiating, trying to talk someone into landing an airplane for the first time, some kid is landing a jumbo jet, you would not be walking. You'd be focused. If you've ever been to a conference where someone is in a really crowded room and they're taking a busy call, you can see them intuitively trying to shut down all the other channels. They'll close their eyes. They may put a finger in their ear and they'll literally face the corner of the room. And sometimes they'll kneel down. They will literally be trying to do everything to focus on what matters.
Right.
And we forget that more often than not. So I could go on. What I usually do is I share that there's almost, I think there's like less than 0.5% of people that can actually multitask in any circumstance effectively.
Right. Well, and it totally makes sense.
That's just being average at it, not great at it. So it's a bad recipe any way you go. And I usually tell people, if you've done the first thing, which we skipped, identify your one thing, just try not to multitask when you're doing your most important work. Mm-hmm. I multitask every Saturday when I'm folding the clothes. I don't get paid to fold clothes.
Right. You can afford to be bad at that.
Yeah, I can afford to be bad at that. And I can afford to be bad at watching soccer or football, right? I can hit the DVR and go back. But I don't like the task. And that's one of the ways I make it more pleasant. But when I'm writing, right? When I'm editing, when I'm doing the things that I truly get paid for, that's my brain surgery.
Mm-hmm.
That's me being a rocket scientist, right? Those are the things where if I was doing those other professions, it would be illegal for me to multitask.
100%.
If you're a bus driver, you're going to get sued if you're multitasking, right?
Exactly.
If you're a pilot, it's illegal to do it. If you're a surgeon, that's why someone else hands you the scalpel. They don't want you to avert your eyes. When lives are at stake, they won't let you do it. And my admonition to people, when you're doing the core work in your profession, the one thing, as we would call it, whose life is at stake?
100%.
It's your life, because it's, I chose to be a writer. I'm not going to kill someone by multitasking, but my life might be at stake because that's the thing that I've made a stand around being good at.
Right. Well, and I think it's great for, as we talk chiropractic wise, because we know that a lot of our practice members come in and they're trying to do all this multitasking. And then what happens is it fires the stress response and it shuts off your frontal lobe. So that's why it lowers your IQ, because it's actually overrunning our nervous system. And part of what we're trying to do through the chiropractic adjustment is improve proprioceptive input to our brain to be able to shut that back down so that we can get back in the present. And when we talk to a lot of chiropractors, that is the power of the chiropractic adjustment, is being in the present, because yes, it's the same activity, but it has way more power when it's just like the surgery or landing the jumbo jet. We're in that present moment. So
to acknowledge your people, a chiropractor is another word for entrepreneur, right?
Yeah.
You've gone through school. You've acquired probably debt for a lot of people right along the path.
A lot of debt. Yeah.
Sunk investment in this business move, and you've learned a profession. But most people in chiropractic school, do they tell you how to get new customers? Do they tell you how to build a website and to do billing? Do they tell you how to hire staff?
Nope.
For the most part, most professional educations don't include that. That's like why people then go get into deeper debt to get an MBA. So right, it's an entrepreneurial pursuit, and that's one of the main audiences we wrote for with the one thing. I mean, we like to talk to business people. And if you don't have a receptionist, guess who is the receptionist? You are.
Exactly. And that's how some start.
Yeah, and you're the janitor and you're the accountant and you're all of those things at different times. And the key is, are we being appropriate in the moment? Mm-hmm. Right? When do I put that hat on above the other ones? And that takes a little forethought and planning, but it is possible. And they're not all equal. Not all of those roles matter.
Right.
As now, much.
Yeah, it's true. Now going back to the number one thing, because I skipped it to the number two, what are some suggestions on how to find out your one thing? I know you talked about there's some questions you can ask yourself.
Well, the first lie is everything doesn't matter equally. That was before multitasking is a lie. That's how we let off the book, right? So I'll give you two answers to this, right? In violation of the one thing, but they're both progressive. On the simplest level, if people didn't really want to adopt the whole book, I would encourage them, we call it extreme Pareto, right? It's a very simple exercise, takes about 3 minutes. Pareto's principle is just simply this idea that you get the majority of your results from the minority of what you do. Some people call it the 80-20. Are you familiar with that?
You bet, 100%.
So 20% of what we do gives us 80% of our results. And I think it's kind of a business law like gravity.
Yeah.
When I look under the hood in businesses, I find it to be more often very true, extremely true than not. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got a long list of things to do in your practice, we would ask you to do this simple exercise on Monday morning before you launch your business. Of all the things that you could do, circle the ones that you really should do.
Right.
Most of us intuitively know the difference, but we don't write down our list in those order. We've just recorded all the stuff that we know we have to do.
Right.
So here are the handful of important ones. So you might go from 25 tasks to 5. And then there's one additional step. If you could only do one of those things this week, Don, what would it be? Right. Only one thing could get accomplished this week on this list. What would you make your stand around? Well, guess what? That becomes number one. And then you say, well, if I got that done and had time and resources left, what would be my number two? And then that becomes number two. And I've thousands of people that we've, you know, trained or coached through this, like you've watched them go from a list of 20 to 30 things down to 3 to 5. Mm-hmm. And there's two amazing outcomes. One, now you've got a list that's based on true priority. These are the things that are most important. Because I've had these days, right? Because when I'm not following my own book's advice, I'm going to do the things that I can cross off the fastest.
Right.
What I want is to make the list shorter. And I'm battling the length of the list, not the quality in the list. But when I stop to do this, which I try to do every single day, then I'm identifying today I only have 3 real priorities. So why don't I just launch my day with them? And then you can knock those things out first and feel pretty righteous the rest of the day.
Yeah.
The reverse, where you do everything that doesn't matter. You come home completely exhausted. Your spouse says, how was your day, Don? What did you do? And you're like, well, I was busy. Like, what did you do? I don't know. Like, you've had those days where you were so, activity and productivity are not the same.
Exactly.
Productivity is activity around your priorities.
Yes.
And so that simple exercise, we call it extreme Pareto. First, identify the handful of things that matter and then rank them in priority so that you can do them in priority. It takes like 3 minutes. Most of us know what our one thing is. We just haven't stopped to acknowledge it. And we feel guilty at the end of the day for not having given it the time it deserves. Mm-hmm. So at the heart of the book, and for those of you like watching the video on YouTube or whatever, we dedicated the entire back of this book to a question mark. Because we were very clear that if there was one thing that someone would do when they finished reading this book, we wanted them to ask a question. What's my one thing? Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I think is the beating heart of the book. We call it the focusing question. It's a very simple tool, not simplistic, but it's a very specific tool that we use to help identify it. What's the one thing I can do such that by doing it, everything else would be easier or unnecessary? It's a mouthful, I know, but like you read it a few times and you memorize it, but it's a very specific question. So it's one thing, it's not two or three. If you ask your brain to come up with the most important thing, it's really good. Yeah. And it's not what you could, should, or would do. It's what you can do. Right? That's a very specific word. And the such that by doing it, everything is easier or necessary, you're looking for the most leveraged action you currently have. Using the 80-20 as an idea, what's that thing that I can do that makes everything else easier or necessary? Not just something I can do in general. It's that thing that makes the biggest impact.
Right.
And you'd be surprised when people ask a big question, they can get a big answer.
Yeah.
And well, that's where that's the second more powerful. If people are ready to buy in a little bit, I would tell them to go there. Look at that list and just ask that question. That number one should pop right off the page. Mm-hmm.
And I saw one of the videos, you were using the example of dominoes, right? How when a dominoes fall, maybe you could tell a little bit about that story about how a little thing can actually have a big effect.
Well, when we first titled the book, The One Thing, the first thing all of our, you know, New York publishing partners said is, what do you mean it's one thing? It's never one thing. You know, who has one thing to do?
Right.
True. It doesn't matter if you're Gary Keller or whoever, you always have more than one thing on your list. But our goal was to get people to start with their priorities, right? To know what the true priority was. So the best analogy we could come up with was falling dominoes. If you line up dominoes properly, if you knock over one, what happens?
Knocks another one down.
That's right. It will start a whole chain reaction, right? Mm-hmm. So one action gets you a multitude of results, right? So that's right. Kind of parallel. So it's about, we call it lining up your dominoes. Mm-hmm. And the scale of that, like in the real world, like there's a group that's lined up, I think 4.5 million dominoes in the Netherlands. That's the world record. And at least it was the last time I checked.
Yeah.
So one activity unleashed about 13 minutes of falling dominoes to get to the end, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And then one of our researchers found a really obscure, this is like how geeky we were getting, a guy named Lauren Whitehead wrote in the American Journal of Physics back in 1984 or 86 that a 2-inch domino could knock over a 3-inch domino, and a 3-inch domino could knock over a 4.5-inch domino. Essentially, every domino has the power to knock over one that's 50% larger. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, we have a big graphic. It's across two pages, right? Where as soon as I heard that, I got out Excel, started with 2 inches and just made it grow at that rate. And I turned to Kyla, our researcher, and I said, tell me what these correspond to in the real world, right? I know what a 2-inch domino looks like, but what does a domino that's a magnitude 18 times greater look like at that same, if it's growing at that rate? And so by 18 dominoes, that progression would have knocked over one as tall as the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
Wow.
By the 27th, I believe it would knock over one as tall as the Eiffel Tower. And most people don't realize that that's as tall as the Empire State Building. It's an enormous building. It just didn't have a downtown around it, right?
Yeah.
And I think by the 31st, I'm doing this from memory here, it would knock over one 3,000 feet taller than Everest, and just 57 dominoes into it, theoretically, it would knock over one from the Earth to the Moon.
Wow.
My favorite part of that graphic I love the idea of just the tumbling dominoes. And if you look on the internet, there's a lot of people who tried to build them really big.
Yeah.
And they're pretty entertaining. But if you do the right thing, not only do you get this idea that you can get a lot of results from it, but you can build a kind of momentum. And so anything you graph that grows like that, right, it's a geometric progression. It's growing exponentially, right, 50% by 50%, but it could be 5%. If you do that on a long enough timeline, eventually it looks like a hockey stick.
Totally, yeah.
You know a little bit about that. You're in Canada, right?
You betcha.
So they call it a hockey stick graph, and it feels like nothing's happening until it's happening so fast and so big you can barely get your mind around it. And I like to say that that's the shape of extraordinary success.
Right.
People are doing the right thing, often in the background, before they've got any notoriety, before they've been acknowledged for doing the right thing, and they're laying this foundation for explosive growth down the line. And that's really how amazing businesses get built.
That's awesome. So a person finds out what their one thing is. They make their priority list. They knock out all the things that aren't that important. Tell us a little bit about how we can create discipline. I saw a little video you talking about discipline. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about discipline, and then we'll talk about after that how to create habits. I love how you're
the same. It's the same conversation.
Yeah.
So I think that when people they identify their one thing, the things that matter most. Again, they're not going to multitask when they do them. Like, one of the next things they'll say is, "Gosh, you know, if I was just disciplined like Gary Keller, if I was, you know, just disciplined like Dr. Don, then I would also be able to do this." And what we discover is like that phrase came up a lot.
Yeah.
And most people don't know what it means to be disciplined. If you ask a kid what discipline means, what are they going to tell you? I think it's punishment. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Discipline is being punished. As an adult, we tend to think of it as a whole other concept, which we define as willpower. But being disciplined is this sort of, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. You know, if I just power through this, I can be disciplined and focused.
Right.
The actual definition, as we understood it, is discipline is training yourself to do something until it's habitual.
Nice.
And so if you are a chiropractor, right, or an real estate salesperson or a writer or a programmer, most professions, if you look at the top people and ask them, what's the one piece of advice you would give everyone? What's the one activity that you think you did that others didn't? There's usually a very common answer. Mm-hmm. It's not the easy button. It's usually lots of hours at doing the unglorious, simple work that adds up to big success. Like in real estate, I can tell you it's lead generation.
Right.
You asked enough people for business. And the people who ask more always end up, no matter how good a practitioner they are, they always end up bigger.
Right.
Always.
That's probably very similar to chiropractic.
I almost can guarantee you it.
Yeah.
That you will look at someone and you'll go, well, dadgummit, John and Jane over there, they stink as chiropractors compared to me. Why is their business bigger? I know I serve my customers better.
Yeah.
Well, then you should do a better job of lead generating so that you could serve their customers better. They've gotten in front of more customers and that's why they have more. That's usually the one thing for almost any entrepreneurial pursuit. So you look up and you say, so if there is one thing that more than anything else is going to lead to my long-term success, doesn't it make sense to take that activity, instead of it being a chore, just turn it into a habit? Mm-hmm. And I usually make fun of my kids. They're almost too old for this now, but I've got a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
My son has firmly learned to brush his teeth a minimum of 2 times a day. I don't have to remind him. He just brushes his teeth in the morning and he brushes his teeth at night. My daughter is on the cusp, okay? But I can remember for years as a parent going, hey, have you brushed your teeth? Really? Let me smell your breath, right? I don't Did you do it today? Did you do it this morning, right?
Yeah.
And we forget that simple act of maintenance, it's a chore that we all do, hopefully you do twice a day at the minimum, right? Yeah. It adds many years to our lives, but it's a chore that our parents force us to make into a habit. And I wake up now, and before I go to bed, no matter how tired I am, I can make it to the sink and manage to brush my teeth. It's not something I have to think about. It's not something I have to plan for. I don't have to have it on any to-do list because it's just automatic.
Yeah.
And that's the goal. Like, what would our world look like if the things that mattered most, even if it took 12 and a half years of your parents yelling at you to get you to do it, what if that was just automatic and every day you did it? Mm-hmm. And that's the question we ask. And most people misunderstand discipline. And then when they do understand it, they don't understand how long it takes to actually form a habit. Most of the literature that we found, and this is common, business books said 21 days or 30 days.
Right.
And I heard 21 days a lot. I would just pull.
Me too.
Yeah. And that's completely bogus. There was no science behind it. Everybody was quoting everybody else's book saying, you know, Don said this in his great book. And Don's looking, well, they said this in their great book. And yeah, they had citations, but they were all circular.
Right.
And there was no real research behind it. So we did find some Australian researchers that had asked this question. And long story short, they found that on average, no matter what kind of habit you were trying to form, it could be anything from, I'm just going to drink 8 glasses of water a day, to really difficult ones, like I'm going to quit smoking. On average, it got as easy as it was going to get after 66 days.
Wow.
So it's like more than 3 times as long as most people assume, which is one of the reasons why so many New Year's resolutions fall apart. One, they try to do too many things, it's too complicated, and they don't put enough effort into it. They give up long before the battle's over. Mm-hmm. And I would just caution people, like, okay, great, I've got a new number, 66 days. We even went to the effort of trademarking it, 66-day challenge, because we believe in that idea. But if I were to tell you, Don, I'm going to ask you, what's the average temperature in North America right now? Did you find that answer?
I have no idea. Yeah.
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares?
Really?
You have to dress for Edmonton today, and I had to get dressed for Austin.
Yes.
So averages are really informative, but in terms of our individual circumstances, they can also be meaningless. So the takeaway on the 66 is it's longer than you think, but for every individual, it could be very different. So don't just say 66, hooray, I'm done.
Yeah.
When we looked at the actual data, some habits were formed in as little as 18 days. There were very few.
Great.
And many took as long as 254 days.
Wow.
They averaged out to 66. And one of the big things I tell people, like, this is a superpower. If you can figure out something that really, really is relevant to your overall success and happiness and make it into a habit, you go through that cycle, whether it's 66 days or 254. Once you've got a habit, maintaining it is fairly easy. Now you get to look up and say, well, now that I've formed that habit, what habit could I form next? And when people start stacking, they call it stacking habits, that's when you look up and it's, you know, a couple of years down the road and people are like, how do you get it all done? Like, you're in shape, you've got a great marriage, you read books all the time, and you're having all this professional success. Well, it didn't happen all at once. Most people that I look at have formed a key set of rituals around each of those, and they've turned them into habits.
Yeah. And I really liked in the book when you talked about our willpower is like the cell phone battery, like the bars on the on a cell phone. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that, about trying to create the habit while you still have bars.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was the fourth lie in the series of six. And it's this idea, a lot of people, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. This is now what most people think, they call it discipline, but it's called willpower.
Right.
It's the ability to say yes to what you need to do, and the ability to say no to everything else. Mm-hmm. It's actually the engine that powers our focus. Focus isn't zeroing in on something. It's actually eliminating everything else. That's how it works in our brain. Can we make the background disappear so that all I'm focused on is this? And it takes a fair amount of actual energy. And there's two different ways that they measure it, but the predominantly one that the research was really validated when we were doing it is there's literally an energy drain. If I give you a test of willpower and measure your blood sugar before and after, it will drop every time. And it's incredibly fragile. Meaning this, like a cell phone, right? That's really old and you have to plug it in the morning, you have to plug it in the car, you have to plug it in at work, because every time you make a call or watch a video, you're worried that it's going to burn out. That's actually closer to the way your brain works.
Right.
So one of the cooler experiments they did is that, they asked a bunch of people to memorize either a 2-digit number or a 7-digit number. It was a guy named Baba Shiv at Stanford University who did this research. And so 7 digits or 2 digits, right? A phone number or 2 digits. I don't even know what that would be, right?
Yeah.
Everybody had as long as they wanted. And when they were done, they had to walk down a hallway and regurgitate the number they memorized from memory. That was the entire test. Well, guess what? Everybody who's listening to this could do either of those tasks. And so it was 100% completion rate. And the real test wasn't one of memory, though. It was of willpower. And in the hallway between the two rooms, they had a table set up and it said, "Thank you so much for participating in our experiment. Please choose one of these two free snacks." And they could choose between fruit or chocolate cake. And if you memorized seven digits instead of two, you were 50% more likely to choose the chocolate cake. So five extra numbers was enough to undo people's diets. Wow. And I immediately just got chills. I was like, okay, well, this explains so much. It's like when we run out of our decision-making power, I won't say we make bad decisions. What we tend to do is go to whatever our default setting is.
Yeah.
And my default setting is not an apple. It's much closer to chocolate cake, right? Because yes. I haven't formed a solid habit of eating that healthily all the time, right? I'll take beer and nachos over, you know, hummus and carrots any day. So it takes willpower for me to make that choice.
Yeah.
And knowing that about me understands like, okay, I need to do the things that I won't naturally do when I still have willpower. And without going into all the research, I'll just say that pretty definitively, when you show people the research and I ask them, based on when you think you'll have willpower, would you do your most important work in the morning, in the middle of the day, or in the evening? Without fail, whether they're 5 years old or 50, they all go in the morning. Mm-hmm. Because the human being, and this has got to do with literally, you know, your blood sugar, whether you ate properly or slept properly or not, that nighttime period, we store glycogen in our muscles, right?
Yeah.
Everyone has a better reservoir in the morning than they do the rest of the day.
Right.
So when we need to say yes to that new habit, that's why you listen to these interviews on the Tim Ferriss podcast or whoever, and they'll ask, what are your morning rituals? Well, people are tapping into something very powerful. Mm-hmm. People who are really successful, I've read one piece of research, they on average get up 2 hours before they have to be at work. Or is it 3 hours? 2 or 3 hours. There's a lot of people who show up at work with their hair still wet because they just hopped in the shower and went, right?
Right.
Super successful people, like they have pushed so much into the hours before they even get to work because they've intuitively figured out this is the best time for that habit formation. So they meditate, they pray, they might read books, they might journal. Like there's all those activities, you know, exercise. Mm-hmm. And then they show up and so many of those boxes have been checked. It's amazing what they can do.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny. I remember the book, Don't Eat the Marshmallow Yet, all about delaying gratification.
Oh, yeah, the marshmallow test. We have that in the book too, but yeah.
Yeah. And that's actually, that might've been one of the first places I heard. I remember I saw it somewhere, but that makes sense too, though, is that when you use up your willpower, you just have the inability to delay that gratification and you'll kind of automatically slip to whatever the immediate fix would be, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's why I know in my family on Friday nights, like it's the end of the week, my wife and I, if the kids say, let's have pizza for dinner, we roll over and show our bellies. You know, it's just too easy. I'll give you an example. I was talking to my partner, Jeff Woods, that runs our podcast on The One Thing. And we actually interviewed a chiropractor on episode 96. His name was Adam. And I can remember the big points here, but this is an example of how one habit in your life, we call it the halo effect.
Yes.
And he did the analysis with the question. He was asking, you know, he had a business to run, all those things. And he decided that the real priority for him was his own health. He had no me time. He was so focused on running around and taking care of everything else, no me time at all.
Yeah.
So his one thing, he was going to form a habit for 66 days, was to walk every morning by himself. Mm-hmm. And he relayed that he wrote a note to us. This is why we interviewed him. He started with that one thing. And so he started feeling better about himself, right? He started walking. He started showing up to the office with more energy. And his clients, do you call them patients or clients?
Or practice members.
Practice members, right?
Yeah.
Started commenting that, wow, like this is feels different, right?
Yeah.
And he started getting more referrals. And so walking started to grow his business.
Yes.
Well, because he was getting up early to walk, he started to go to bed at the same time his wife was going to bed instead of staying up late and working because he had a reason to get up in the morning.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Their marriage started getting better.
Yeah.
It's amazing what happens when you go to bed at the same time as your spouse. You don't have to go there, right? But he told us. And so his romantic life improved. And then like this other like weird ancillary thing, he started listening to audiobooks in the morning when he was walking. And he shared that like, he'd been listening to these audiobooks on investing and he just bought his first real estate investment property. So the halo effect for me like Adam is a chiropractor. So I was like, I got to know the details. Jeff, show me, walk me through the story again, because it's relevant. Identify the most important thing. And the thing that I think people find out, especially entrepreneurs, is that they conquer one tiny area of their life. Even if it's just 5 minutes that they suddenly like, wow, I actually have control over this. Yeah. And I think that kind of breaks a dam that's like, oh, if I can control this much territory on my daily calendar, why can't I take that extra time? And they start slowly. It's like an invading army. They've got a head. And instead of being swept through their days, they've now got this one moment where they're completely in control and they feel really good about it. And then they start expanding it. And I've lived it. Mm-hmm. I've seen people live it. And if there was the simplest, broadest application of the book, it would be to encourage people to ask that question and just to establish their own personal productivity beachhead in the morning. Let themselves know that they can truly be back in control instead of kind of being adrift in the stream of life.
Right.
Did I just mix a million metaphors? That was horrible. Okay.
I love metaphors. I'm all over it. So bring them on. I'm like metaphor king. So I think that's great. Well, that's awesome. So in closing here, we got a bunch of chiropractors out there. It's called Breaking the Underdog Curse. A lot of times, chiropractors will feel like an underdog, or maybe they are an underdog. They just don't have the skills. So do you have any parting words of wisdom to inspire the underdog nation out there?
Everybody roots for the underdog, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, in my hometown, everybody's talking about the national championship game. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't go to the University of Georgia, the University of Alabama, then everybody is rooting for Georgia because they're the underdog. Right. And I've seen that to be a truth in life. And so while I think it is helpful to take on the attitude of someone fighting for the top, I think you should also know that people are rooting for you and that they want you to win, especially if your intentions are pure, right? So that would be my advice. Go ask the question, figure out what your one thing is. We all know what it is for business. It's lead gen. I just know that for a fact. But start somewhere. It's a crazy world, especially for entrepreneurs. And I think chiropractic is just as crazy as all of them. But establish that one thing and then know that the world's rooting for you to be successful and just build on that. Success, I think people overestimate what they get done in 1 year. And it's incredible if you start looking at a bigger time frame, how much success you can enjoy in 5 years.
Yeah.
So be patient, build on a foundation, and that extraordinary will show up sooner than you think.
And that gave me a thought flash, because I'm going to flip it the other way. We talked about this before the call too. What if you hit success? How do you stay there? Because sometimes people will sabotage success. So just kind of a thought flash just from what we talked about before, but we're talking about once you're number one or you've done really well and hit your goals, what kind of advice would you have for someone to keep it going without letting it all crash down?
I think there's two reasons that people topple from the top. Mm-hmm. Ego steps in and they think that they don't have to do the fundamentals in anymore. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, the people who stay on top never, ever neglect the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is they refuse to change. So it sounds contradictory, but if you don't evolve, somebody out there will start and they will have a different formula for growing a practice and it won't include your cost structure and they will undercut you in some way. And so you can't see it, but I've got a whiteboard over there. And here, I'll give everybody nausea. There we go. Right over there. I keep all my important numbers over there, right? But at the top left corner, it says, how do we become the business who will eventually put us out of business?
Right.
And Gary asked that question, and he's always been willing. And it seems like about every 5 to 7 years, he's willing to completely unwind the company to make sure that it's still competitive in today's landscape.
Yeah.
And you can't do that all the time. That's crazy. It'll make all your people quit.
Yeah.
Periodically, you never neglect the fundamentals, but you also ask, how is the world, the landscape around me changing? And how must we adjust to remain competitive in this environment? And the great ones do this. Mm-hmm. And they keep doing it and they keep evolving. And the ones who don't kind of fade away into obscurity. Mm-hmm. That's been my observation of what the difference is. So don't neglect the fundamentals. And pay attention to the competitive landscape because you may have to adapt.
That's great. Now, if anybody's interested in contacting you or any of the products or stuff that you offer, how could they contact you or get in touch?
Thank you for asking. I'd say the best place to go would be theonething.com with the number one. So it's theonething.com, and it's got links to my social media, all of our free resources, and links to all the stuff we're doing. So that's a great place to start. I mean, my name's Jay Papazan. I'm very Googleable too, because there's like, I think one in the United States.
That's pretty good. That's pretty unique. And of course, buy the book, because I think the book was amazing. And I want to thank you for being on the podcast and agreeing to come on. That's amazing information.
All right. Thank you for having me, and go Underdogs.
You betcha. So everybody out there, there's like so much information. You have to listen to this podcast over and over again, get the book, take some notes, and all these things will help you get out there and crush the curse.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you receive value from this episode, please take some time to rate and review us on iTunes or your favorite place to listen to podcasts. If you know a fellow chiropractor that could benefit from this message, please share it with them. Because it's my goal to provide you with great content, please contact me if you have any questions at drdonmcdonald.com or find me on Facebook. I look forward to hearing from you. So until next time, Dr. Don out.